and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh's accuser, Christine Blasey Ford, going public and offering to testify before the Senate Judiciary Committee and take a lie detector test to support her charge that Kavanaugh and his friend Mark Judge held her down as Kavanaugh tried to sexually assault her in the upstairs bedroom of a home where Kavanaugh and his classmates at Georgetown Prep were having an alcohol-fueled party. Deborah Turkheimer, a professor of law at Northwestern University School of Law and a former assistant district attorney in Manhattan, who is the author of numerous articles on rape and domestic violence, joins us to assess whether Kavanaugh will take a lie detector test, since the issue before the Senate is likely to no longer be about sexual assault or attempted rape, but lying about whether the incident happened or not. We will also examine the credibility of denials by Mark Judge, who has written two books about his teenage years at Georgetown Prep, Wasted, Tales of a Gen X Drunk, and God and Man at Georgetown Prep, which chronicle being, quote, completely annihilated while trying to hook up. The only likely reference to Kavanaugh in Judge's writings comes in a passage where a girl at a party asked Judge, quote, "Do you know Bart O'Kavanaugh? I heard he puked in someone's car the other night," to which Judge replies, "Yeah, he passed out on his way back from a party." Then we'll look into the court filings in the Manafort plea deal with Robert Mueller to assess the extent to which Manafort was working for Russia against American interests, and speak with Craig Unger, the author of the new book just out, House of Trump, House of Putin, The Untold Story of Donald Trump and the Russian Mafia. He joins us to discuss how Manafort was not on the Ukrainian payroll but on Putin's payroll all along, with the only other person having stronger ties to Russia and the Russian mob being Manafort's boss, Donald Trump. Then finally, we will speak with James Thurber, the University Distinguished Professor of Government at American University, whose latest book is Congress and Diaspora Politics, The Influence of Ethnic and Foreign Lobbying. He joins us to discuss how much Robert Mueller is bringing attention to FARA, the Foreign Agents Registration Act, which Congress passed in 1938 to go after pro-Nazi propagandists. Since then, it has been allowed to languish as K Street super lobbyists like Manafort brazenly ignored it until Trump's former campaign manager was just about to be tried under it and made his recent plea deal with Mueller. And joining us now is Deborah Turkheimer, professor of law at Northwestern University School of Law and a former assistant district attorney in Manhattan. She teaches and writes in the areas of criminal law and feminist legal theory and is co-author of the casebook Feminist Jurisprudence, Cases and Materials, and the author of numerous articles on rape and domestic violence. Welcome to Background Briefing, Deborah Turkheimer.
Thank you very much.
And what do you make of what's shaping up as another Anita Hill type of situation before the Senate Judiciary Committee? A last minute evidence emerges, the Judiciary Committee is called back, and the witness lays out her case against the nominee. Obviously, this time around, the Republicans, including the president himself, seem to be very cautious. President Trump today said, there'll be a little delay, you know, no big deal. And the White House counsel is suggesting that she should be heard. So at this point, they seem to be, at least on the Republican side, seem to be taking a different tack. But where do you think this is heading?
Well, I think this is a powerful moment. This is obviously hugely impactful in terms of the course of this nomination, and it has repercussions far beyond the Kavanaugh nomination as well. As to where it heads, obviously a lot depends on how Christine Blasey Ford presents when she appears in front of the Judiciary Committee. But I would expect, based on the account she's given to the Washington Post, that she will have plenty of details to offer, and she will have a very good explanation for why she waited to come forward until she did. I would expect that for many senators, maybe most senators, certainly not all senators, but she will seem to be a credible person who is telling a very painful story.
Well, as far as we can tell from the denials, the consistent denials from Brett Kavanaugh himself and from his friend Mark Judge, who the woman in question, Christine Blasey Ford, said also held her down while Brett Kavanaugh tried to sexually assault her. And indeed, her lawyer, Deborah Katz, says that she believes that but for Kavanaugh's inebriation and his inability to take her clothes off, he would have raped her. So obviously, at this point, the issue will not be so much sexual assault and rape, but whether or not Kavanaugh lied.
That's right. This is a serious, serious allegation. There's the claim that force was used, which is universally recognized as being against the law. And so the question here will be, are the senators persuaded that this is a credible account? I think it's going to be very difficult for someone to make the case that that she's believable and yet it doesn't matter. I have a hard time seeing that comes out of this. And again, because Kavanaugh denies that this incident took place, I think it's going to be very difficult to argue that the passage of time offers some sort of redemption. Redemption would require acceptance of responsibility and remorse, and then we could have a conversation about whether the decades that have intervened changed the calculus. But that's not what we have here. We have a competing account that is the diametric opposite.
Well, Mark Judge, who is accused along with Kavanaugh of being involved in this attempted rape, he became a writer and a filmmaker, and he's written two books about his time at Georgetown Prep. One is called Wasted, Tales of a Gen X Drunk, and the other is called God and Man at Georgetown Prep. And both books are replete with teenage drunkenness, alcohol-fueled parties, getting completely annihilated on alcohol and trying to hook up. My sense is, in a way, he's introduced a kind of milieu here for this possible situation that is at the heart of whether or not Kavanaugh is going to be confirmed. He himself, Mark Judge, initially said he didn't recall, and then he denied it along with Kavanaugh, but now he's saying he didn't recall. So at the end of the day, could drunkenness, being completely obliterated, be a defense that why you can't recall anything?
Well, I should say I haven't read his books. I've read some of the excerpts that have been circulating in the past few days, and I agree that they seem to paint a picture of a lot of intoxication and behavior that we should all be troubled by. As to whether intoxication is some sort of defense in this context, it doesn't seem to me that it would be. As far as I know, Kavanaugh has unequivocally, categorically denied this. There's not the contention that he remembers it, but his memory is fuzzy because he was intoxicated. This is really just a competing account. Where Mark Judge fits into all of this, I think we'll have to see it play out in the coming days as far as what he's able to say with greater specificity about what may or may not have happened on this night, according to him.
And again, I'm speaking with Deborah Turkheim, who's a professor of law at Northwestern University School of Law and a former assistant district attorney in Manhattan. She teaches and writes in the areas of criminal law and feminist legal theory and is the co-author of the casebook Feminist Jurisprudence, Cases and Materials, and the author of numerous articles on rape and domestic violence. So in terms of the politics, Deborah, obviously the two women that, in effect, the Democrats are targeting in the hope that they can peel off Susan Collins and Lisa Murkowski. Already, Susan Collins, she spent an hour on the phone with Kavanaugh on Friday. She has called for a full hearing on this. Obviously, this is all in the context of the clock ticking on the Republicans who clearly want to rush this nomination through and get Kavanaugh confirmed before the elections, presumably as a kind of trophy, if you will, for their base. How would you rate the situation in terms of whether or not these two women on the Republican side could be influenced. Clearly, Susan Collins has made it clear that she wouldn't vote for somebody that would overturn Roe v. Wade. She's accepted his assurances that it settles law. But frankly, from the hearings themselves, some of the information that came forth, particularly in the Gaza case involving a 17-year-old immigrant on the border who was pregnant, particularly in the questioning by Maisie Hirono, indicated to me that Kavanaugh may be saying one thing, but he may well believe another thing, which is that he wants to get rid of abortion.
There are many reasons to oppose Kavanaugh's nomination. I don't know where Collins and Murkowski were going to fall on the question had it not been for this latest twist. As to where we are now, I think it's significant that the two and other senators as well were very clear about the fact that this allegation needed to be aired, that this was not something that could be pushed under the rug and have the Judiciary Committee proceed as business as usual. And so I am somewhat heartened by the fact that there was agreement, and there has been some widespread agreement about the need to slow this down. Obviously, we don't know how Collins and Murkowski will react to the testimony itself, but I do think it suggests that these allegations are being taken seriously, and we can hope that the hearing will be fair. We can hope that the woman, Christine Ford, will be treated fairly, and that her testimony will be judged without bias, without prejudice, without resorting to myths about how survivors of sexual violence behave.
So this would mean, surely, that they're not going to have their vote on Thursday, which is what the Republicans were hoping for.
I think the hearing has been scheduled for Monday. At least that was the latest news flash that I saw. So if that's the case, then yes, the vote has been postponed.
So what about the offer on the part of Christine Ford that she would take a lie detector? Would that be something that Kavanaugh would agree to as well?
Well, I don't know. She did take a lie detector, and according to the Washington Post report, she did pass that. Those results would not be admissible in a court of law, but in the court of public opinion, I imagine it goes some way toward persuading some people that this is a truthful allegation. I haven't seen any reports about whether Kavanaugh has offered to do the same.
Well, we know that the Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell apparently urged the White House not to put forth Kavanaugh's nomination. He had other alternatives in mind, and that's led to speculation that there are some skeletons in Kavanaugh's closet, and one of them is the possibility of having a problem with gambling. That led Senator Sheldon Whitehouse to submit questions in writing to Kavanaugh, in which he denied that he did any sports betting and said he basically just plays poker with friends. Is this a case of a lot of smoke? And frankly, if this situation wasn't being so rushed and all of the documentation wasn't being held back, there's so much, this percentage of stuff. I think at this point, the Democrats on the committee say they've only got about 10% of what they requested. So where do you come down on this? Do you think you can make a judgment when you've got these accusations swirling about based upon 10% of the paper trail?
Yeah, there's so many factors involved here, and I think your question points out that this has been a very complicated process with a lot to be concerned about. That said, at this point in time, for good reasons, all eyes will be on the Senate Judiciary Committee when this hearing resumes. And I think the immediate question for the senators will be how to respond to this very serious accusation. Again, there are plenty of other reasons to oppose Kavanaugh's nomination. It looked like that was going to break on party lines, although there were some senators who, of course, hadn't committed. But this is not a partisan issue. It shouldn't be. It may be that this, you know, this is more impactful in terms of that end result.
Well, the Anita Hill hearings certainly gained extraordinary media attention. I believe it may have been some important baseball games that were actually postponed because they didn't want to lose their audience. So I don't know whether we're going to have that kind of attention, but I presume there's going to be a lot of attention on, if it's going to be Monday. Do you expect that? There'll be a lot of people tuned in?
I do. I think that even apart from this Me Too movement that we find ourselves in the midst of, this would be important and this would captivate the public. But the fact that it's occurring when it's occurring and that we've had nearly a year now of conversations around sexual assault and sexual harassment, credibility, and sort of questions of when and whether to believe accusers, well, I think all of that in the mix is going to really highlight the importance of this moment and how the Senate responds.
Well, of course, Monday, those questionings of both the Christine Ford and presumably Kavanaugh would be done in private. But at some point or other, we should expect public testimony, surely. Surely the Democrats are going to demand that, are they not?
They probably will. They probably should. She's made clear that she's willing to testify publicly. Kavanaugh's made clear that he's willing to do that. So I don't know what's happening on Monday as to whether it's public or private, but I would anticipate that at some point, you know, unless there's another surprise turn, that the public will hear from them.
Well, just in closing, one of the ironies, of course, of the Anita Hill hearing was that it so outraged so many women that many of them ran for the Congress and the Senate. And the two senators from out here, Barbara Boxer and Dianne Feinstein, entered the Senate as a result of their anger at what had happened to Anita Hill. And Barbara Boxer was just on television the other night pointing out that, of course, not only was Anita Hill treated shamefully, there were three other women that were prepared to come forward to buttress her version of, because it was a he said, she said, and there were three women prepared to come forth and buttress what she had said. And Joe Biden, the Democrat in charge of the Judiciary Committee at the time, decided not to allow them to come forth. So I take it it's a somewhat different political lineup at this point on the Democratic side, even though there have been some criticisms of Senator Feinstein.
It is different. The shadow of the Thomas hearings loom over what's going on now, and these proceedings will be, you know, very much compared to what happened with Anita Hill. But yes, a lot has changed, and changed for the better from the perspective of our response to these kinds of problems and these kinds of allegations. That said, it really remains to be seen when the dust settles how this moment is evaluated and understood. And again, whether this process is fair, whether everyone is treated with respect, with dignity, or whether it goes in a different direction and brings Anita's Hill treatment to the front center of our minds.
Well, Deborah Turkheimer, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Deborah Turkheimer, who's a professor of law at Northwestern University School of Law and a former assistant district attorney in Manhattan. She teaches and writes in the areas of criminal law and feminist legal theory and is the co-author of the casebook Feminist Jurisprudence, Cases and Materials, and the author of numerous articles on rape and domestic violence. We're going to take a brief station break and back look inside the court filings in the Manafort plea deal.
Never.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Craig Unger, the author of the New York Times bestseller House of Bush, House of Saud, the former deputy editor of the New York Observer and editor-in-chief of Boston Magazine. He has written about the Trump-Russia scandal for the New York Republic and Vanity Fair, and his latest book just out is House of Trump, House of Putin, the untold story of Donald Trump and the Russian Mafia. Welcome to Background Briefing, Craig Unger.
Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you, Craig. And we spoke recently, and you mentioned, in fact, it's in your new book, House of Trump, House of Putin, that the Russians have been financing American politicians for some time, particularly Republicans. And that was pretty alarming. But then when you see what's just happened now with Mueller's charges, or the plea deal that he made with Manafort, it's so extraordinary how deep Manafort's ties were to the Russians. They keep reporting, and it drives me crazy, that he was working for the Ukrainians. Manafort never worked for the Ukrainians. He always worked for the Russians. He was actually on Putin's payroll. So what's it going to take to get that picture clear? Because I keep seeing on the footage they keep replaying of Manafort going in and out of the courthouse, there's a guy in the background holding up a sign that says traitor. Well, I'm with that guy.
Well, I agree, absolutely. And I think, understandably, a lot of Americans don't know much about the politics between Ukraine and Russia. And while technically Manafort was working in Ukraine, he was completely, you're absolutely right, he was completely representing Russian interests. And we know that because he was being paid by oligarchs like Oleg Deripaska and Dmitry Firtash. And you are not an oligarch unless if you're an oligarch, you do so, you're in that capacity with the blessing of Vladimir Putin. You are serving Putin's interest. And Paul Manafort was absolutely serving his interests throughout the whole thing. He was, everything he was doing was against American interests. It was to install a pro-Putin puppet in Ukraine. And that really goes to the root of what this entire Trump-Russia scandal is all about. Money. If you want to follow the money, it begins there.
Well, one of the extraordinary things in the rather damning book that Bob Woodward's come out with, Fear, is that the former National Security Advisor, General McMaster, apparently was tearing his hair out because Donald Trump was literally being handed by the Russians Russian talking points about Ukraine. And apparently General McMaster, as a National Security Advisor with all the assets that come with that job, he couldn't find out where Trump was getting this Russian disinformation from. So is it possible that the Russians have a back channel to Trump? Because, you know, we know that Jared Kushner was trying to set one up. What do you think?
Right. Well, I think it's much more than possible. I think it's highly, highly probable. And when I write about the Russian mafia and Trump's links to them going back 35 years, you know, one point I really want to get across that I think a lot of Americans don't understand is that the Russian mafia is very different from the Italian mafia, Italian-American mafia that we know in the United States. And the biggest difference is it is a state actor. Russian mafiosa are essentially agents of Russian intelligence. And Trump has been dealing with them for over 35 years. He's been laundering their money through his real estate. They've been living in Trump Tower in New York here and in other Trump properties, and they partnered with him. He was $4 billion in debt, and they made him whole again. They made him rich again through their partnerships with him. And that's a very, very close relationship. And that in itself is a very direct, represents direct channels right to the Kremlin.
But your book indicates, Craig, House of Trump, House of Putin, the untold story of Donald Trump and the Russian mafia, when we started talking about the Russians not just funding Trump, but also other Republican politicians. I recall that there was a meeting of the House leadership, the Republican House leadership, at which Kevin McCarthy says to Paul Ryan and others in this meeting, "I swear to God, Donald Trump and Dana Rohrabacher are on Putin's payroll." And then, of course, immediately Paul Ryan says, "Well, you know, keep that to yourself. Let's keep that in-house." Now, that conversation is being verified by Evan McMullen, who was then the intelligence liaison to the House Republicans. So that happened. So what do you know about Rohrabacher and these others? I mean, how long have they been on the Russian payroll, and what's the quid pro quo?
Well, there's a lot of, I don't know all the answers to Rohrabacher, but you're right in that he's been pro-Russian for very, very long. And I did trace to some extent the beginnings of this. And certainly if you go back to the 90s, if people remember the Jack Abramoff, Tom DeLay scandal. Tom DeLay was speaker, the Republican Speaker of the House. Jack Abramoff was a powerful, powerful lobbyist. And they kept jetting off to Moscow on occasion and being amply rewarded. And I think a lot of this, part of what is the scandal, is what's legal. I mean, the Russians are taking advantage of flaws and lack of regulations in our campaign financing system, in our lobbying system on K Street. Paul Manafort and Roger Stone are a great example. They were known as on K Street in Washington as the lobbyists for the dictators, lobbyists for the tyrants. And they represented people like Jonas Savimbi or Ferdinand Marcos, who had stolen billions from the Philippines. They were famous for that. Then they transferred it, moved to Manafort, of course, went into the Ukraine. There were other people, along with Rohrabacher, one of the early ones was a Pennsylvania congressman named Kurt Weldon. And we found that his daughter was on the payroll. I think she was a 23-year-old daughter, and she was making $500,000 doing publicity for a Russian gas company, a Russian energy company. So people did get payoffs in many different ways. There's a man named Leonard Blavatnik, is a Ukrainian oligarch, but he's a naturalized American. And he put in $11 million to the Republican Senatorial Campaign Committee. And that goes, and Senator Mitch McConnell is in charge of that. Some of the money went to Lindsey Graham. A lot of people were wondering why Lindsey Graham seemed to flip and become pro-Russian the minute his good friend John McCain died. Well, he looks like he was getting money from the Russians as well. And I think that is, I'm sure I have not gotten all of it. I'm sure there's a lot more than I've found.
And again, I'm speaking with Craig Unger, who's the author of the New York Times bestseller, House of Bush, House of Saud, the former deputy editor of the New York Observer and editor-in-chief of Boston Magazine. He's written about the Trump-Russia scandal for the New Republic and Vanity Fair. And his latest book just out is House of Trump, House of Putin, The Untold Story of Donald Trump and the Russian Mafia. So now that there's been a plea bargain with Manafort and you know, the way that we learn about what's going on with the Mueller inquiry is on the court filings, where they lay out what, you know, there's been an information blackout. The White House keeps trashing the DOJ and the FBI and Mueller, and so does Fox News, and he can't speak back. But to some extent, he does through these court filings. What did you make of the latest court filings?
I thought it was fabulous. It was like it's a treasure trove for the investigative reporters everywhere. And let me just tell you two things that are sort of buried in it that I think the average listener might not uncover, the average reader who might even dig up the document. But if you look in the documents, you'll see that Manafort, one of the companies he used to launder money was a company called Lucicle, LLC. It's a shell company. And that company has been traced to ties to a very, very powerful a Russian mobster named Semyon Mogilevich, who is who's sort of the financial genius behind the Russian mafia. So that's a very, very important link, because Mogilevich's people, his operatives, began laundering money through Donald Trump as early as 1984, many of them actually lived in Trump Tower. They partnered with Donald Trump. And remember, the Russian mafia, unlike the Italian mafia, is tied to they're essentially like Russian intelligence agents. They are part of Russian intelligence. Another thing I found in the Mueller papers had to do with, it said that Manafort was in touch on a very regular basis, and they don't name the man, but they say he was chief of staff to the president of Ukraine, President Yanukovych. Well, I have the man in question, his name happens to be Sergei Lavochkin. And Lavochkin is important, too, because he's also a partner with Mogilevich. So you have two powerful ties between Manafort and the Russian mafia, and these are the same mobsters who've been tied in with Donald Trump for 35 years. I think it's just an enormous security breach.
Well, when I mentioned the video clips of that they play on TV of Manafort going in and out of the court in Virginia, and there's this guy standing behind holding up a sign, traitor. One of the things that Manafort did for Putin was the U.S. has always had a problem supplying the war in Afghanistan. They have to go through Pakistan, and the Pakistanis gouge them and occasionally blow up the trucks and close off the Khyber Pass and et cetera. So the U.S. found an alternative in Kyrgyzstan in the north of Afghanistan, and they set up an Air Force base at Manas, and it became an important alternative. So we had some leverage over the Pakistanis. So Putin sends Manafort down there to organize a coup against the leader of Kyrgyzstan who had made the deal to let the Americans in, and they put in a more pro-Putin guy instead, and they kicked the United States out. So that's treason, isn't it?
I'm not a lawyer, and I don't know what the legal definition is, actually. I mean, whether it requires a declared war, but he's certainly doing everything he can to undermine American policies. And that, you know, the Manafort's ties to Trump, you know, it's almost laughable. You've seen Trump on TV say again, well, Manafort, he only worked for me a few weeks. That is lunacy. They first started working together in 1980, 38 years ago. Manafort was introduced to him by Roy Cohn, the dark satanic prince of the McCarthy era, and he helped him win zoning battles and so forth in his early development. And he and Roger Stone have been close to Trump for a long, long time. Those relationships are very important.
So where do you think this is heading then, Craig Unger? The assumption is that it's really making Trump paranoid, that this is the biggest shoe to drop, having, you know, you've already got guilty pleas from Trump's former national security advisor, his deputy campaign manager, a foreign policy advisor, and his own personal lawyer, and you've got his CFO cooperating with the feds. So if you add Manafort to that list, the former campaign manager, it's like the walls are closing in on Trump.
Absolutely. It's like checkmate. I mean, if you look at Watergate, Nixon kind of folded after John Dean testified and went against him. Everyone you've mentioned, I believe, has flipped, and there's six or seven of them. And that gives Mueller the luxury of being able to play them all off against each other. So they can't really afford to lie because they'll be locked up in the slammer, and Mueller can verify it with five or six of the other people who flipped. So I think Trump is in real trouble, that we're on a collision course. There's going to be a train wreck. And if the rule of law prevails, he will be impeached or forced out one way or another, or forced to resign. If it doesn't, and I think he's totally unpredictable, I'm not going to predict what he's going to do, but he could start a war as a distraction or resort to other completely extra-constitutional means in a way that I think will cause a major, major constitutional crisis.
Well, apparently the Republican leadership, that's Ryan and McConnell, have told Trump not to fire Jeff Sessions before the elections because it's going to cost the Republicans in the midterms. But that doesn't mean he's not going to fire Sessions immediately after the midterms. And if he fires Sessions, that could lead to him shutting down the Mueller inquiry. And the other hand that Trump could play is that the Mueller inquiry doesn't, there's no requisite for it to go public. You know, Mueller just hands it over to Rod Rosenstein, and it's up to Rosenstein whether it's made public. So we're not really on strong ground there.
But a number of these prosecutions are, Mueller has handed off to other jurisdictions. So some are going on in the Southern District Court of New York, some in other jurisdictions all over the country. And my understanding is that Trump does not have the authority to shut those down. It would be very interesting if the Democrats win the House and, you know, and I think they would start impeachment in the first of the year right away. But Trump will, no doubt, it's going to be a very interesting fall and winter, because I think all of this is going to come to a head, and I don't think anyone can predict how it will play out.
Well, just in closing, back to Manafort, my understanding is that one of the main factors in why he decided to flip, apart from the fact that it was costing him a lot of money, the lawyers were costing him a lot of money, and he was about to face another trial where he had a much less friendly judge. The judge in Virginia was just ridiculously pro. What did you make of that judge? What was going on with him, Ellis?
Yeah, he seemed like he was very anti-Mueller, didn't he? The interesting thing was, look how tight Manafort's case was. He had 18 counts, and he actually had, we know, some real real Trump loyalists on the jury. All but one of them, but even so, they were able to win, I believe, on 8 counts.
They were, and the 10 counts that they were deadlocked on, Manafort just pleaded guilty to all of those counts in his proffer to Mueller.
Right.
So, but my understanding is that what changed his mind, Manafort's mind, was the fact that his daughters, who he dotes on, and they're obviously very spoiled, they apparently want to change their surname. They don't want to be called Manafort anymore. And that really...
Right, one of them actually has done so already. I believe she took her mother's maiden name.
Right.
It's also, if you look at... I don't know if you've seen the text messages between the two daughters, but they're quite something, and they refer to Manafort's actions in Ukraine, saying, you realize we have blood on... That money is blood money, and they're saying that the father played a role in the slaughters that happened at Maidan Square in Ukraine, and that, of course, he was very much on the as you've said, on the pro-Russian side.
Well, he was actually there in the palace that we saw what it's like with all the gaudy furniture and stuff that this crook, Yanukovych, had lavished himself with at the expense of the Ukrainian people. When the slaughter was going on, the Ukrainian citizens protesting Yanukovych, guess who was right beside Yanukovych while he was killing Ukrainians? Paul Manafort.
Right. Yeah.
Physically.
Paul Manafort.
Right by his side.
So
his own kids aren't wrong to say that he had blood on his hands.
Absolutely.
Well, Craig Unger, I thank you for joining us. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you for having me, Ian. I appreciate it.
And again, I've been speaking with Craig Unger, who's the author of the New York Times bestseller House of Bush, House of Saud, the former deputy editor of the New York Observer and editor-in-chief of Boston Magazine. He's written about the Trump-Russia scandal for the New Republic and Vanity Fair. And his latest book just out is House of Trump, House of Putin, The Untold Story of Donald Trump and the Russian Mafia. We're going to take a brief station break and back look into whether the Foreign Agents Registration Act will be strengthened because of its abuse by Manafort.
And now, a word from the president.
Damn, it feels good to be a gangster. Getting voted into the White House. Everything looking good to the people of the world, but the Martin family is my boss. The voters of the world keep supporting me, and I promise to take you very far. Other mothers better not upset me, or I'll send a million troops to die at war. To all you Republicans that helped me win, I sincerely like to thank you.
Elected us as willing partners. Look who's not on the ticket.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is James Thurber, the University Distinguished Professor of Government and founder and former director of the Center for Congressional and Presidential Studies at American University in Washington, D.C. He's the author of numerous books and more than 80 articles and chapters on Congress, interest groups and lobbying, and campaign and elections. And his latest book is Congress and Diaspora Politics, The Influence of Ethnic and Foreign Lobbying. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Thurber.
Good to be here.
And shortly after Citizens United became law, President Obama, at a State of the Union address, castigated the ruling and said it would lead to the influx of foreign money in our elections. And the representative of the Supreme Court present there was Samuel Alito, and he mouthed, "Not true." But in retrospect, who was right, Obama or Alito?
Alito, in the sense that it's illegal for any foreigner, foreign corporation or foreign government to contribute to campaign finance in the United States. But there's lots of money, hundreds of millions of dollars being paid to lobby for those foreign interests. And in many cases, people are not registering to do that lobbying. And that's part of the democratic process here. They just can't be involved in campaigns. Now, we're seeing that that Russia looks like has intervened with respect to social media. And if some people have been hired to represent an interest, there may be a case where people are running advertisements and other things, not for candidates, but for general causes that influence the way people think about things.
Well, Paul Manafort, I think, has opened a whole can of worms about K Street and shedding a light on the kind of bipartisan nature of the corruption there, which...
By K Street, you mean Kiev Street?
So do you think that the Foreign Agents Registration Act will be bolstered? I mean, if you just look at the case of Paul Manafort, back in 1986, he had more than 10 foreign governments he was lobbying for as clients, and he was running their media campaigns in the United States. He was meeting with White House, State Department, and congressional officials on behalf of these. And by the way, these are pretty much all very unsavory regimes. He apparently was told that he had to disclose these activities to the Justice Department under the Foreign Agents Registration Act. And 32 years later, he is now, well, he was facing charges in the D.C. courts. The day before he was jury selection, he caved and made a deal. But he was going to be charged under FARA for his activities with Ukraine. So obviously the warning back in 1986 didn't do anything and didn't stop him from lobbying all those decades.
He knew better. In fact, when it was Black and Manafort, you know, 25 years ago, Mr. Black, well-respected in town, said that they were very careful about registering when they were representing a foreign nation or foreign political party or leader. He knew better. He just ignored it and went on. And one of the reasons he ignored it is the norm in Washington, D.C. at that time, and right up until he was indicted, Flynn was indicted, Gates was indicted on these issues, people just ignored it in Washington. Like in the movie Casablanca, and they come in and there's gambling going on. There's gambling. I'm shocked. Well, there's lots of people in Washington, D.C. that are now registering ex post facto for foreign clients because they can get in trouble. This is a very serious law. It's a felony. You can go to jail. And it also is a law that reveals a great deal about what you're doing for the foreign client because you have to reveal the entire contract. So it's not just making contacts like in the Lobby Disclosure Act. It's also whether you're doing grassroots, taproots, coalition building, advertising, social media, the whole thing. So a lot of people are vulnerable if they're U.S. citizens representing these foreign interests.
So, James, are you saying then that Robert Mueller is reviving FARA? Because he's already nailed Rick Gates on FARA, Michael Flynn on Farah, Sam Patton, the Republican lobbyist who worked with Manafort, and the 13 Russians that he charged, and other companies, three Russian companies, for illegally using social media to influence the 2016 elections. They also were nailed under Farah. And Farah goes back to 1938 when it was used to go after pro-Nazi propagandists.
Yeah, we had pro-Nazis here trying to persuade people to keep out of the war. People were outraged. They passed the act. The question with the act is whether it's been enforced. It has not been enforced. There have been very few, you can count them on two hands, investigations and indictments over the years. This act is very serious. It's broader than the Lobby Disclosure Act. It requires much more to be disclosed. It's triggered by any person, U.S. citizen, acting as an agent for foreign principal. There's an out. If you're representing a company, you can register under the Lobby Disclosure Act, but a lot of people have not done that either. And these lobbying activities are much broader than the Lobby Disclosure Act in the sense that if you have grassroots, you're paying money to a think tank to do white papers. If you have advertising, everything, including contacting people, you must register. You have to say to the penny how much is being given to you and how much is being spent. Now, there's an exception. If you're a foreign government and you're a diplomat, you don't have to register. And that's a very important thing. So in many cases, all the embassies here are lobbying, but they also turn, especially Japan, Korea, Saudi Arabia, they turn to firms, well-known firms, and they're spending hundreds of millions of dollars on representing their interests before Congress. And I think a lot of people on the Hill don't realize what's going on, and they don't realize that these people have not registered. It's a problem.
Well, but to the question, though, do you think Mueller is going to revive the act?
I think that this scandal is reviving the act, and he has triggered the scandal because he's made it transparent about what people are doing. There are several bills on the Hill that are being considered. The one that's probably going to move the quickest in response to this is one by Grassley that gives more power to the Department of Justice, more money, more authority to pursue people that are breaking the law. And they're going to change this little loophole thing for foreign corporations and put it back with Farah and take it away from the Lobby Disclosure Act. I think it's needed, and I think it will happen. Now, of course, we have an election going on and then a lame duck. So there's lots of other things going on in the lame duck, but it'll probably occur at the beginning of the next Congress when it looks like the Democrats will take over the House.
So does stuff lobbying then fall through the cracks between the Lobby Disclosure Act, which is basically operated by Congress to investigate, and FARA, which is the Justice Department? So does stuff...
I correct you on that. The Lobby Disclosure Act was passed by Congress, and I helped write part of it, but it is enforced by the U.S. District of Columbia's attorneys, and they don't do very well at it. And also, some of it is in the Department of Justice. Congress doesn't enforce it, mm-hmm. and they don't even have good oversight hearings to see what's happening. The GAO, the Government Accountability Office, does audits of it also, and they report problems to Congress, but they haven't done much with it on the Hill.
Well, but does stuff slip through the cracks? In other words, for example,
easy to slip through the cracks. We've gone from 14,000 federal registered lobbyists to about 9,000 now. Lots of people are not registering. They're calling themselves strategic advisors or government affairs officials or something, and they're getting around the requirements of the law to register under the LDA. They can't get around it easily with FARA, and that's why a whole lot of people are very worried and down, because they just haven't been registering under FARA, and they should be doing that.
Well, it would seem, though, that countries like Ukraine and Russia, where the lines are blurred between what is a private corporation and what is a government.
Absolutely. And that's one of the big loopholes. And especially, you know, in China also, you don't know what's being run by the government, what's being run by the party, and what is truly a private sector organization.
So given that some of the revelations that have come out of the court filings in the plea deal that Manafort made with Mueller just on the eve of the second trial, where he was going to be nailed for foreign lobbying, wasn't he? That was one of the
Absolutely.
Big charges, right?
They have allowed in the past retroactive compliance by the Department of Justice, and he tried to do that with some of the things that he did, but it was so far back, and there were millions of dollars that's where they nailed him. It's a criminal statute, and he got nailed under it, and this is a major lever on Manafort and Gates to talk about what they did for then-candidate Trump, but what they did for years that was against the law under Farah.
Well, some of the names that have come up in terms of those that it looks as though Manafort sort of tried to get some sort of bipartisan decoration, if you will, for his activities. And one of the mistakes I think that the press keeps making is they talk about Manafort's activities with the Ukrainian government. He was never paid by the Ukrainian government. He was paid by the Russians, you know, to install.
It looks like the money flowed from Russia into accounts in Ukraine and then to him, and then he put it into offshore accounts. He tried to keep them secret. But, yes, he tried to make it bipartisan. He hired Tony Podesta, the Podesta Group, to represent a think tank in Brussels, here in Washington, D.C., that would make the president that he was working for then look like he was not corrupt and to help improve the image. He also paid former prime ministers in Poland and one other country in Europe to write op-ed pieces in favor of this guy. So he spread the money that he received internationally, but also in a bipartisan way in the United States. He hired Podesta firm, was a Democratic firm. He hired also Republican firms.
And I think you're referring to Romano Prodi, the former prime minister of Italy.
Yes, that's right. I'm sorry.
No worries, no. But another name that came up, too, in terms of putting some bipartisan decoration on Manafort's lobbying activities, he also hired Tad Devine,
who was a well-known campaign specialist and pretty well respected. He hired him. He got sucked into it.
Right.
But also Vin Weber, a Republican, and others. We don't know all of them for sure because it hasn't been revealed yet.
But Tad Devine was Bernie Sanders' campaign manager. So,
right. And he's been in almost every campaign for the last four or five cycles.
Well, is there any chance of a physician heal thyself?
Well, I think that when scandal occurs, there's an effort to have reform, but I think a lot of people begin to look at what they're doing, and they hire outside counsel to look at what they're doing, and they try to change their behavior. There are firms in town, law firms, that do election and also lobbying law, and they come in and they do audits, and they say, hey, you're breaking the law. You've got to change your behavior. So that's already started, especially by the major firms that are very worried about their reputation. You know, it takes 30 years to build a reputation. You've heard it in 5 minutes to lose it. And Tony Podesta knows that well.
So what about the broad issue of lobbying itself? I mean, the word, I believe, comes from the fact that they hang out in the lobby of the Congress, right?
Well, there's a variety of reasons why they call it lobbying. It really goes back to Parliament in the United Kingdom. There's a lobby office floor where people would stand and try to persuade people. Then there was the lobby of the Willard Hotel during the Lincoln presidency where people would try to lobby. And then there's the lobby off of the House and the Senate floor. So that, you know, you don't need to use any of that, but you should know that, you know, it's the background of it is there's a variety of reasons for that. Lobbying is absolutely essential, I think, in a representative democracy that's a pluralist democracy where we have First Amendment rights, we have the right to organize, we have the right to hire people to represent our interests. What we need is more transparency about what's going on, and we need enforcement of existing law. if we had enforcement of the existing law, FARA, as well as the Lobby Disclosure Act, there would be lots of things that would change. The main thing that may not change, though, is that we have 8,000-9,000 registered lobbyists. We probably have 100,000 people in the Washington area involved in advocacy, which means coalition building, grassroots, top roots, television production, ads, social media, funneling money to think tanks. Many think tanks are just advocacy tanks. It's a huge business in this town, and people don't know very much about it. We need to know more about it.
But the representatives themselves in the House and the Congress, is there any way for them to know who's lobbying on behalf of a billionaire or a big corporation and who's lobbying on behalf of a grassroots organization? Because there's a phenomenon that's called astroturfing, where you have phony grassroots.
Yeah, fake grassroots.
Yeah.
Fake grassroots is where a firm goes out and they hire people to organize people in a district to then send emails, letters, calls into a member of Congress. And it's really fake in the sense that people don't care that much about it. The organizers from Washington, D.C. are out there doing it. I think it's unethical. It's legal, but it's unethical. And I think that there are many things that are legal but unethical that should be cleaned up. I teach a course on ethics and lobbying. We go through the law, but we also go through the norms. And it's time for more reform.
Well, on that note, we wait with bated breath, and I thank you for joining us, James Thurber.
Sure. Yeah. These are excellent questions, and you really know what you're doing. That's not always the case from people following this story. I'm glad you're doing it.
Well, thank you. And again, I've been speaking with James Thurber, the University Distinguished Professor of Government and founder and former director of the Center for Congressional and Presidential Studies at American University in Washington, D.C. He's the author of numerous books and more than 80 articles and chapters on Congress, interest groups and lobbying and campaigns and elections. And his latest book is Congress and Diaspora Politics, The Influence of Ethnic and Foreign Lobbying. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasts at backgroundbriefing.org. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.